So since there were many questions about metta, actually, I didn't get to answer them all. And probably tonight I won't be able to answer them all. But tomorrow morning I thought after the first sitting at 7:50, you know, when you do the movement, the exercise, or you go walk, there'll be a possibility for asking questions about that specific practice. Okay, so if I don't answer all your doubts or questions about the metta practice, it will be done tomorrow, and hopefully this will do. So we understand that we've been practicing with mindfulness or awareness practice in the moment to simply see a little more clearly, right? What's manifesting in our mind, what's manifesting in our hearts, and with a clear sense of disentanglement in relationship to what's being seen. And naturally enabling a little bit more balance in relationship to what is emerging. Now, there's no doubt that that quality, which we call understanding, bringing more wisdom, may flourish and manifest in our life, in our relational life. We have been on a retreat where there's an intense program where we hold the intention to look inwardly, just for the sake of seeing more clearly what it is that is manifesting in this mind of mine. And clearly, the more we understand our own mind, the more we'll be able to notice when we go into the world what will be acted out, how we will relate, right? And I think that a lot of it is manifesting in both ways. We interact, and we also give a flourishment to a greater understanding, and it goes both ways. So these teachings that the Buddha taught also encourage us to widen our focus, to include how we relate to others. There's no doubt that you can say the Buddha was a man of relationship. For no reason, when he began understanding his own mind and why, what was the cause of suffering, he dedicated so many years to alleviate the suffering in other people and had so much to give and to offer. And in fact, when you read a little bit of the sutras, you understand that he was an active person. And so it's the focus is also to include how we relate to others, how we recognize, in a way, also our interconnectedness. So when we practice metta meditation, like we did just a little bit, I mean, 3 times 45 minutes is really not much of practice of metta. But I think for some of us, we kind of had a little bit of the flavor. And so the aim, if you want, is the dedication of ourselves to just enable our connection with this care and kindness, which eventually becomes unconditional. Investigating what it is that closes our hearts, what it is that is sometimes not enabling the possibility of that connection. And there's no doubt that in the Vipassana practice we can see that at times the mind and the heart are obstructed. In the metta practice, this will manifest in a very clear way at the relationship of emotional state, because just we are at that level of a much more clear domain of the emotional. Just when you speak heart, right, we hear, and there's this whole aspect that may manifest. So the Buddha talked about metta being this very basic goodwill, or if you want, benevolence, right, which I called care, kindness, gentleness of heart. Now, it's understood in the Buddha's teachings that this quality is the expression, if you want, that manifestation of a mind and a heart that's not veiled with what we called here the wanting mind or attachment, the aversion and the confusion. So it's a very natural ability that we all have, capacity to feel gentle and kind. And there's no doubt that at moments, you know, we feel it very strongly, actually. And so this is weird, you know, sometimes people ask me, but why should there be a practice to feel this ability of care and kindness? And in fact, a few people have said during this retreat, I feel it very spontaneously in my life with people when it's needed, when there's a possibility of offering my kindness. Well, there's a smile and there's an openness, you know, why should there be? It's really weird, it feels artificial, which it may, because we're not in a rapport or a relationship where this is included. And yet, why is it that we bring in this practice at times? Well, to be able, first of all, to relax, ease the heart, ease the mind. There's this quality of openness, which no doubt is manifesting in our Vipassana practice. And there's no doubt that when we are in reactivity, which may happen at times, then this quality that I talked about the other night of openness, of greater ease, of allowing, is the gentleness. It is the care. And so this is why it's quite helpful to bring it in a way where there's just an easing out. Otherwise, we just stay on the side of reactivity. So there's a clear intention, and it's working with intention to see the good, to be able to go in the direction which is opposite to the one of negativity. So within a practice where there's framework, there's different possibilities and different entry doors. Now, it's absolutely possible that at times in our practice, it's maybe not the appropriate time to do metta practice. And I remember that I had a very strong resistance to that very easeful and good and kind practice when I began, because I was very interested in the Vipassana practice, very interested in watching the mind and noticing what was happening. But so many times the teacher would say, please do one metta sit every day. And I would not do it. Because I thought, oh no, this is kind of wishy-washy, you know. Doing kindness, it doesn't relate to me. I want the wisdom and I really want to understand. What I had not perceived was that my way of relating to what was happening was with a lot of clarity, but it was with a lot of aversion, which I had absolutely not felt. I didn't feel that underneath the clear seeing there was a lot of aversion. And it's finally when I realized that I was bumping walls that I thought, okay, I need to do something. I need to listen to this teacher. And when the metta started arising, there was just a sense of, you know, easing it down, relaxing. And this is exactly what allowed me to see, oh, but there's aversion here. Plenty of it. And it began to enable and ease the path in relationship to that very deep emotion that was not met at one level, at the surface level. So it's amazing. So that's one of the purpose. So when we begin to taste metta, the quality of a heart that is beginning to open, and it's not this big openness, it's just a little bit open at times maybe, but it's still open. It's not closed, which is very different. And because it's open, there's a sense of a wish, an aspiration to care, rather than stay closed. And so you can understand that that same quality can very deeply affect then our lives. That we open and we care about other beings' happiness or well-being, it matters. It's basically a goodwill without that tendency to close down when there is the presence of difficulty. So it really kind of balances out the type of negativity that we can meet. So we start out easy, and it's very important to do so. When I said a few times that it doesn't matter who you choose, it really doesn't matter who you choose. And that is not easy to understand, because I think it's important to have a sense that who we choose is in a way equal, because the practice is happening within ourselves, right? We're transforming our own mind and heart with different situations. And some were not understanding this, asked about, but if I'm not then sending the metta outwardly to the other person, you say, okay, may you be happy, may you be well, may you be peaceful, may you be safe, may you be protected, whatever, right? Even though there's an expression, a radiation to that other being that we are being with, right? There's a sense of transformation within myself. Okay? Now, often people have the question, is this received by the other person? When we have this sense of kind of connection. Well, that's the mystery. There are stories, and I have some of them, well, you have really the sense that at that moment when you did some practice, right, that person said, did you think of me that moment? And I said, yes, I did. I was sending metta to you. Wow, it really helped me. Okay, so that's the mystery of life, where we understand that there's an interconnectedness. Okay? It may happen. It may be completely the opposite of what I'm describing. What I know is that if we take certain situations and then we work on them and we really relate at the level of being in the presence of that situation and working with what is happening, there's no doubt then when we meet the person, then there is definitely another way of being than if I'm not aware, present, and caring about that situation. There's no doubt that that is definitely helpful. Now, what one needs to know is that we, in the practice of metta and in relationship to doing this with a lot of wisdom, we are certainly not expressing and radiating metta to change another. This would be called, I hope you know by now, wanting, right? So we have the aspiration, the wish, the wholehearted care, tenderness to wish well. Wishing well for another is completely different than desiring for another. And that's quite an important distinction. So metta is really this quality of heart and mind which cares, but it's not attached to results. Meaning that it's also called a care and a kindness or a love, not based in self-referencing. Where me is so important that I'm really not so concerned about just the sending and the aspiration, but there's in my heart, in my mind, a need, an expectation, a demand, some wanting. Now there's no doubt that in relationship to the practice and how it unfolds, we are going to meet these things. And it's important that we meet them, because this is exactly what we call, when I said the purification process, this is exactly how we purify, right? Our heart and mind and see, and slowly, there's a sense of more clarity. But true metta doesn't have this sense of self-possessing or wanting it to go a certain way. This is why we say that it is unconditional. That we don't need to have certain conditions for it to flourish. So that's why it's also very helpful to bring and to have a sense where we begin easy. And we can stay, since it's not about choosing certain situation specific, any object or any situation is the same, since it allows for this quality to flourish. It's very good to have a sense where if we've had this little bit of contact, and there's connection with the easy being, whether it's ourself or another being. Often people think babies or pets, animals, you know, because they're sweet beings and they're vulnerable, so it's easy to get in contact with, which is great. You can do months with this quality of metta in relationship to a small baby or a pet or even a flower, if that's where your heart leaps, or a tree. That quality of kindness and care will grow. And it will not only grow for that specific situation, but it will just manifest and flourish, because it's our own heart and mind that grows in that direction. So that's wonderful, you see. So with metta practice, we really encourage the ease. And we access these embers of kindness and care, and because they're there, and we fan them, we encourage them. We encourage, if you want, if you have embers, you know, the flame to grow. And of course it will grow as we do the practice, like anything else. If we don't practice, well, there's little chance that this quality can really be settled in ourselves. At times, we are ready, but as I'm saying, it's a very clear sense of having a foundation where there's really ease, and just like when you build a house, you need to have a very good foundation before you have a roof on top of the house, right? Otherwise everything crumbles down. So when we have this good foundation, and it takes more than two or three sittings, please hear me, it takes quite a lot of practice, but then we can really take situations which are a little more challenging. And that's the purpose, in a way, that we are opening up. Then maybe we have certain situations or people that are difficult for us. And then very slowly, gently, with the help of our practice and bringing in, of course, the vipassana, we can then open up to these people that maybe causing us difficulty or for whom there is a challenge. And for quite a number of people, it can be ourselves. It's absolutely not rare because of the amount of aversion that we may have for ourselves. And this is why for me it was extremely difficult, because I had been given the instruction to start with myself, because it was very rigorous the way it was done. And why wasn't I able to express this is because I had a lot of self-aversion. And so I was hitting a wall until I went to the West, and in the West there's more flexibility in presenting the teachings. So a very kind teacher said, you don't need to begin with yourself, and take an animal, take a flower, take whatever. And it was amazing, because the difference is, in the East, they don't know what self-aversion is. It's amazing, but it's true. I mean, there's a whole story, but probably some of you know it, that the Dalai Lama at a conference in Dharamsala had so many people, and they were teachers, and many of them were Vipassana teachers, and the question to the Dalai Lama says, how do you do with all these people that don't like themselves, that have self-aversion? And he says, what are you talking about? You know, he had absolutely no idea what these Vipassana teachers were talking about. Why? Because I don't think in Asia they have. They said, why would you add suffering on suffering that's already present? And it's fascinating, because it's true. It doesn't appear to be one of the problems, which is definitely so present in our societies. So it opened up the fact of being able to know that there was another way through, or another pathway than the aversion that I was talking about that appeared when beginning metta was definitely self-aversion, which transformed after some time, thank goodness. So doing this practice, we're creating the conditions for happiness. And every time there's a phrase, or there's a sense of, oh yeah, let me, you know, just move in the direction, just care, open to whatever it is, we plant a seed for happiness to arise, or for peace to arise, or for safety. It's said that this metta practice is an antidote against aversion, anger, fear, annoyance, blame, shame, all of these emotions that pertain to the category of aversion. Why? Because it's exactly the opposite, right? It's goodwill, it's kindness, it's care, and finally it infuses our heart. The Buddha says this, he says, the thought manifests as the word manifests as the deed. The deed, you know, the action. The action develops into habit, and habit hardens into character. So watch the thought and its way with care, and let it spring from love born out of concern for all beings. So we see the cycle, right? Thought coming into word, word manifesting as action, action developing into habit, habit hardening into character, personality, identity. So he says, go back and watch the thought and its way with care. Let it spring from love born out of concern from all beings. So these are powerful words, in a way, where we really kind of move and have the quality of intention which nourishes, feeds the wholesomeness, the kindness, the care, the intention of going into benevolence. So there's a whole understanding that when we are in the process of vipassana, we say, okay, yes, you know, allow, because it's opening to what is, to understand, and then to kind of let go, right, of whatever hurts. And there are many aspects in the practice where we move in the direction of, in our lives, for example, yes, we have a choice. We can choose. There's an intention, there's a possibility, and he's very clear here, saying, whatever I nurture, this is what will become the habit. And in fact, one of the great lines of the Buddha is this one. He says, whatever one thinks about and ponders upon, this is what we will become. So in relationship to metta, there's a very clear sense of nourishing kindness, care, which not only benefits us, but out of concern for all beings. So we have this possibility of meeting whatever it is, and yet in many ways we also nourish positive thoughts, positive actions, positive words. Body, action, and verbal. Right? Body, speech, and mind. So as we do this practice, our hearts and mind just become a little softer, more flexible. What feels so hard at first just is a little bit more amenable, more pliable. And it's just how it works. The practice, I can tell you, really works. It's amazing for having done it. I've got so much trust today. I would even say faith. If there's one type of faith and trust that I have, is in the practice. And there's such a quality that it softens us. And then one may have, you know, the fear or the idea, okay, but if I'm going to be so soft, I'm going to feel really vulnerable. And the world out there isn't filled with metta. Some of it is, but not all the world is filled with metta, no doubt. So we know, we really have a sense where there's maybe places where I need to be kind of firm, right? And stand on my own feet to know, and not be just everybody's nice. So there's a real understanding, actually, that this quality of metta has nothing to do with sentimentality. So one of the neighbors of metta is attachment, right? Possessed love, attachment, wanting. And it's a near neighbor, and we see it, and there's no doubt that at times there's going to be love and care with attachment, and, you know, until we're fully liberated, this is what we're going to have. I can tell you, I still have it. So, be patient. You know, I mean, not have at all any attachment. It's a very ambitious scope, right? It doesn't happen until full enlightenment, so, you know, be patient. But there are moments where the care and the kindness comes in front. Now, the other close neighbor is what we call sentimentalism, where we have this sense of, oh, the world is so kind, so nice, so beautiful, you know, everybody's so kind. That's not what true metta is. True metta has at its root wisdom and equanimity mostly. So there's a quality of softness, but there's the strength and the balance of the wisdom practice, which exactly tells me when I can be open, I'm soft, And there's the absolute quality of centeredness, which knows when to say the appropriate response. So there's openness, there's this quality of metta, and yet we don't say yes to everything. If there's harm, we don't say yes. But how do we say no? That's the thing, you see? So if there's clarity and there's metta, there's a sense where we have the appropriate response. And one teacher said, what did the practice teach you? How would you say or define the fruit of the practice? And he said, the appropriate response to circumstances, to life situations, to have the appropriate response. Well, a lot of the time, you don't have the appropriate response. So it's a learning. What does it mean to have the appropriate response, right? It's to be able to say sometimes no, but in a way that is not aggressive, that is not coming out of that aversion and that state of anger, which, of course, it will happen. But ideally, when there is this quality of true metta, more and more with wisdom, there's a sense, because we're clear and we're aware and we're open, that, okay, we kind of know and we sense that things may be said a little differently. And especially when there's a quality of presence, which is there, where I know what is happening within, therefore what comes out is already a little bit different, because I know I have a connection to myself. If I don't have any connection to myself, then anything can come out. But it's really understood that the Buddha said a very beautiful line, and I'm sure you all know it: hatred never ceases by hatred. Hatred can cease by love alone. So the answer to, you know, put more fire when there's fire, well, you're just going to get more fire, right? And we can see this on a global level in this world, no doubt. But it doesn't mean kind of passivity or not take a stand or not respond in the appropriate way when something is not done in a way which is benevolent. It reminds me of a story. I have a friend and a very wonderful teacher of metta. She's known all over the world, I think. Sharon Salzberg, I'm sure you've heard of her name. And she wrote a book even on metta. And she tells the story about being in Bodh Gaya, and one of our teachers was Munindraji, a man in India, and he was a great Vipassana teacher. And one day this woman was in Bodh Gaya, and she was on a rickshaw going to a Vipassana course or whatever, and then the rickshaw guy was not very kind to her, and I think he wanted some kind of business with her anyway. And so it was raining, and she goes to the teacher, and she explains just what happened in the rickshaw and how she had to run away. And he just had one phrase. He said, with all the loving kindness that you have in your heart, you should have taken that umbrella and hit that guy with all the kindness that you had to save yourself. So you see, I mean, it's not that we don't do anything. We're not passive or resigned or surrendering when something so clearly harmful comes in the way. So, yeah, that's, you got the message. So when we say that it is a purification process, it's because we begin to heal and to expose our resentments. So there's no doubt that this metta practice very often doesn't feel very agreeable. Sometimes it does, but when we begin to really open up, for example, for myself, there was a lot of annoyance and fear and resentment and jealousy and, you know, everything that separated me from from kindness and from love. But this is what we work with, and so it's part of the purification process, right? Now, when it comes up, we just allow it to be the way it is, and we absolutely then help ourselves with the wisdom practice, right? Because it's a combination of the two that will be enabling. Otherwise, I'm melting in this anger and I'm not knowing clearly what is manifesting. So it's really important then to open up to the difficult aspect. So on the road to this, what we can call unconditional love, of course we're going to find obstacles to kindness and to care. And this is probably what we've been seeing, you know, some of the retreat. We know them well, right? The wounds and the hurts and the lack of self-acceptance and, you know, everything that's difficult. But this is the way that we learn. I really like the line of a Zen teacher. He says, practice is about learning to be kind, but we will never be kind until we experience our unkindness. Which is absolutely true. How to know about being kind if we don't meet our unkindness? So this is exactly what we need to see. Now the other question that came up is, you know, spending so much time on ourselves and energy, whether we're doing wisdom practice or loving ourselves, isn't it a very selfish thing to do? And I was asked that question quite a number of times. Which is fantastic, because first of all, it encourages us to be able to see more clearly what is happening within us, and there's no doubt then that the change will happen. And as we change, we are able also to be much more willing, patient, and kind to other people that are suffering. I think there's no way out, actually. The more we meet our own, the more we understand that the human nature is made of different aspects. And it's not that, you know, there's only one kind person and they're all kind, and there's one horrible person and they're all hatred. I mean, we each have a combination of many, many types of emotional states, some good ones and some difficult ones. And I think that we all share that predicament. So the more we learn about ourselves, the more we're able then to be really willing to feel and to understand that if somebody doesn't act in the appropriate way, then there probably is suffering. Now the understanding and the intention is to separate that action from the being. They're not all bad. The action may be unskillful, like we have actions that are unskillful. So it's really important to separate the action from the person. The person certainly has good qualities. So with metta practice, we try also to be able to put that to the side and then to nourish and to see the good. And so the way that it works is that the more we see clearly within ourselves, the more we're enabling a capacity to be willing to open to other beings. And in fact, the Buddha said, you can search the world over and not find anyone more deserving of love than yourself. Which is great, because he wasn't at all saying that, you know, there's abstraction in that way. The other quality that I'd like to talk about tonight a little bit is compassion. And the compassion is something that we have definitely been in the face of, no doubt, that compassion is this presence of suffering and being able to open to the suffering that is present. And so the compassion comes out of this quality of kindness and care in relationship to pain. There's a practice called karuna. So we have metta and there's karuna. That's the second of the four Brahma Viharas. And there's no doubt that this care and kindness manifest in relationship to the pain. It's the tender, caring quality of the heart in the face of suffering. We haven't done this practice specifically because I don't think there was time really. Metta already, we didn't have a lot. But if you have the occasion, if there is a course with metta, because sometimes there are courses with, you know, just metta and at times compassion, and you're interested, you feel that you have something that you really wish to approach here, they're wonderful practices. Sometimes people have an easier contact or entrance door with the compassion practice, just because suffering is present. It's in a way much more real, I know, you know, than the goodwill or the benevolence. But one needs again to have a good ground, because as I said, if there's suffering and we don't have a good ground, then we easily go into the opposite state, the aversion to the suffering. Now the near neighbor, the quality that is very close to compassion, is pity. And that's something we often clearly see and we sense. So in relationship to our pain, there's complacency or pity that we'll meet. But still, we're already shifting from aversion to pain to being willing to open. And so when we open to the pain, there's a sense, oh, poor me, right? Or there's a sense of pity. And that's already a path or kind of a step forward to being able to be with the pain. Maybe in not the most open way, but there's already a sense of care, so or connection. Now it's said that compassion in itself is the quivering of the heart in response to suffering. There's a poignancy, there's a tenderness. And I'm talking about this because quite a number of you have spoken about this quality of being touched and being sad. Like there's the tenderness and there's a poignancy and there's really a quivering, like a vulnerability in the front, in the face of suffering. And that is the quality of compassion, which can be exactly at the same place than the place of metta. But it just takes another, just another taste, another flavor. Very, very clearly resemblant, but not exactly the same. Another neighboring quality is despair, which is not compassion. Despair or hopelessness or grief is something where, you know, there's the feeling of the pain, but there's a sense where we're drowning, we're getting caught, and we're kind of hopeless about it. So all of these are steps forward to see. This Sharon Salzberg was teaching in Russia, and she said she had a translator when she was teaching her compassion course. And after a while, she was really looking at the people in the room, and they were kind of, you know, with really dull faces and saying, oh my gosh, this is horrible. And so she questioned the translator, and she said, what are you telling them for the word of compassion? And And he said, oh, I describe a state of being terribly overcome with someone's sorrow, like having a stake through your heart and having the burden of someone's pain burden you. He says, oh, no wonder people are really completely overthrown and overwhelmed by this is not compassion. And so she had to describe all over again. That feeling is not wrong. It's just, again, not balanced with wisdom. It's not balanced with the centeredness of, okay, this feels really painful, but it's okay, there's the equanimity. I'm not drowning in it. Which means that true compassion doesn't hold any aversion. There's really no aversion in it. And that's all there is. So imagine, you know, there's pain and no aversion to the pain. It's quite an extraordinary capacity of the heart and mind to be able to feel this. So it's the natural response that we all carry to care when we see pain. Pema Chodron has a line, when there's pain, love or loving kindness gives birth to natural compassion. The compassionate heart holds the pain and sorrow of life and all beings with tenderness. It is this tender heart that has the power to transform the world. So there's a real quality to these practices of metta, of karuna, meaning loving kindness or compassion. And there's no doubt that it's the expression of our wisdom practice in relationship to other beings. You know, the wisdom practice is happening through relating to our own pain, and we've had plenty of that, I'm sure, these days. You know, so we engage with it, we learn to be with it, we come to peace with it by experiencing it, holding it with a non-judgmental attention to the best of our possibility. And that, of course, also leads us to be more with giving ourselves the gift of compassion. So this is how we learned. Actually, we did compassion practice through the Vipassana practice of engaging, being okay, and at times just allowing whatever it is to be just the way it is. And it's just not resisting. There's a little story that I'd like to just exemplify how it is a process. This is in Nyingyur Rinpoche's book that has been translated in English. He's a Tibetan Lama, monk actually, and his book is called The Joy of Living. It's quite a nice book, and one of the stories I took in this book. He said, I have a Tibetan friend in India who lived next door to a man who had a bad-tempered dog. In India, unlike other countries, the walls surrounding the front yard of a house are very tall, with doors instead of gates. The entrances to my friend's yard and his neighbor's yard were very close, and every time my friend came out of his door, the dog would come out of his neighbor's door, barking, growling, and altogether a scary experience for my friend. As if that weren't bad enough, the dog had also developed a habit of pushing through the door into my friend's yard, again barking, making a terrible disturbance. My friend spent a long time considering how to punish the dog for its bad behavior. At last, he sat the idea of propping open the door to his front yard just a bit and loosely piling a few small heavy objects on top of it. The next time the dog pushed open the door, the objects would fall, teaching him a painful lesson he would never forget. A hard way to learn, right? After setting his trap one Saturday morning, my friend sat by his front window, watching and waiting for the dog to enter the yard. Time passed and the dog never came. After a while, my friend set out his daily prayer text and started chanting. Still the dog failed to appear. At a certain point in his chanting, my friend came to a very ancient prayer of aspiration known as the metta practice, and he began with the following lines: may all sentient beings have happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering. In the middle of chanting, it suddenly occurred to him that the dog was a sentient being, and that in having deliberately set a trap, he would cause the dog pain and suffering. If I chant this, he thought, I'll be lying. Maybe I should stop chanting. But that didn't feel right, since the prayer was part of his daily practice, which he did every day. He started the prayer again, making an effort to develop compassion towards dogs. But halfway through, he stopped himself, thinking, no, that dog is very bad. He caused me a lot of harm. I don't want him to be free of suffering. He thought about his problem for a while until the solution finally came to him. He could change one small word of the prayer. And he began to chant, may some sentient beings have happiness. Isn't this what we do in our practice? This is so true. He felt quite happy with the solution. After he'd finished his prayers, eaten his lunch, and forgotten about the dog, he decided to go out for a walk. In his haste, he forgot about the trap he set. And as soon as he pulled open the door, all the heavy things he piled up fell on his head. It was, to say the least, a rude awakening. Yet, as a result of his pain, my friend realized something of great importance. By excluding any beings from the possibility of achieving happiness and freedom from suffering, he had also excluded himself. Recognizing that he himself was the victim of his own lack of compassion, he decided to change his way. The next day he went out for his morning walk and had a piece of bread. As soon as he came out, the dog appeared rushing out and barking, but instead of cursing the dog, my friend simply threw him the piece of bread. Completely surprised, in mid-flight, the dog caught the bread in his mouth and began to chew. This little game continued over the next several days, and what my friend noticed that even though it kept growling while chewing on the bread, the dog started to wag its tail. By the end of the week, the dog was no longer ready to attack, but instead ran out to greet my friend, happily expecting a treat. Eventually, the relationship between the two developed to the point where the dog would come trotting quietly into my friend's yard to sit with him in the sun while he recited his prayers. Isn't that a beautiful little story? It's exactly what we learn. But he learned the hard way. We also learn the hard way sometimes. But it's all a question of attitude. And it's so interesting because when there's negativity in us, you know, it says, okay, who's going to win this fight? And we're ready for a fight until we understand. And he had quite a lot of wisdom, this man, you know, right? Thinking about the way that he was doing his practice and opening up, and everything ended in a very nice and happy way. But this is what really is requested from us, that we have this chance to see our personal struggles. Rumi has a wonderful line. He says, everyone chooses suffering that will change him or her to a well-baked loaf. Practice changes us from a raw dough to a well-baked loaf, he says. Sometimes we may feel a bit overbaked. That's what he says, which is great. So our ability to feel metta or karuna, loving kindness or compassion in this world, is directly related when we begin to look directly related to making peace with our own suffering. It is making peace with our own suffering, and then very clearly there's a possibility of feeling our humanity. And then eventually this will carry out into the world. So there's a wonderful way that we can see that what we've done here, even if it's been very difficult, and I know it has for quite a number of you, which is completely normal, this wonderful possibility of making peace And there's no way that we have, in a certain way, made peace at times. And that's our ability to really call forth this kindness, this care, enabling us then to go into the world with a little more equanimity. Because it is equanimity that is this fantastic quality that supports also kindness and care, which we call wisdom. This equanimity is just the balance of heart and mind in relationship to what manifests within or in relationship. You can say that equanimity is the absence of reactivity, leading, of course, to then unconditional peace. So we strengthen our heart in that way, and strengthening of the heart is brought about by the equanimity, moving in the direction of just a diminishment of the reactivity. And when there's a diminishment of the reactivity, it doesn't mean there's nothing. Like so many say, okay, so I allow without exception, and everybody took that phrase for, you know, passivity, resign. No, we just have the appropriate response. So it's not about not doing anything. Quite the reverse. We're active. It's a verb. All these practices are verbs where there's action in the world. We go in the world. We do whatever we think is appropriate for us. But deeply understanding the sense of interconnectedness. The Dalai Lama said that what he learned most was not to separate himself from himself. And to not separate himself from himself, it means just feeling a sense where life grows in connection. And that connection also flourishes between beings. And it's amazing because so many beings, you know, are touched by his presence. I don't know if you've ever had the chance to see him in real, but I have, and it's amazing how for each person there's the same feeling that you're the most important person in the room. And there can be 5,000 people in that room and you feel still the most important person in the room, which is incredible. How does he do it? Well, he doesn't make any distinction between people, and he's just got this extraordinary capacity of having an open heart and mind, no distinction, no partiality, interconnectedness. In the same way that he doesn't separate a part of himself from himself, he doesn't separate himself from other people. And that's truly manifest. This is exactly what comes out and is impressing everybody. But, you know, when he's asked, how do you do it? He says, I practice every day. It. I mean, he says, and you can do it too. You know, and I think it's true that he does practice every day, because there's no doubt that there's something very clearly special. So I would like to conclude with a few lines from him. He says, so this is the Dalai Lama, right? The essence of all religions is love, compassion, and tolerance. And I'm sure you've heard this before, but it's just so important to hear these words where he says, kindness is my true religion. This is my simple religion. There is no need for temples, no need for complicated philosophy. Our own brain, our own heart is our temple. The philosophy is kindness. And that's not all he says, because he can give very complicated teachings with full of philosophy. But I think that the essence of his being is really moved by the appropriate response, and more is he saying that, you know, it's not needed to separate ourselves for reasons of identity to whomever. says, please don't change religion. He said this to Switzerland. He said, why do you want to come to this? He says, keep your religion, but just be a good human being. And I love it when he says this. Just be a good, a kind, a caring person. That's how it shows. And it was then, it was not long ago actually. And with so much joy and so much lightness. So it's just that, you know, as we learn to see the good in ourselves and others, we learn to relate with the goodness in others. That's it. It's a very clear way. And in fact, the Buddha was very much like that. He was trying to resolve all the problems that were happening in his own county. He wasn't just, you know, lying back and not doing anything. It said in the sutra that the Buddha was clearly stating that poverty was the cause for immorality and unethical conduct. That if there were crimes and hatred, thieves, falsehood, violence, it was due to the fact that these people were certainly poor, and that at the root of their actions was a lot of suffering. So he needed to do something like that. So he went to the king and he said, give these people good conditions, and of course this will change their lives. And so very much of the time he would try to change the mentality of the rulers of the time. It said really very clearly in the sutras. He suggested that we eradicate crime to heighten up the economical status of the people. And then, of course, things would go better. Well, we can see this today, right? It's amazing what's happening around. Many more things I can say, but I will end here. We will sit for just a few minutes, maybe 10 minutes, and I'll read. If you wish, please come and sit or make yourself comfortable, but for just 10 minutes of practice together to end this day. Appreciating all the efforts that we've been doing, placing in and allowing to see the truth, to understand a little better the nature of our being. Dalai Lama says, don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive. And then go out and do that, because what the world needs is more people who come alive. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive, and then go out and do that, because what the world needs is more people who come alive. ending the sitting with a sense of appreciation for all the efforts that we've been putting in during this day of practice in relationship to be a little more caring, accepting the difficulties, the challenges, the way that we bring in this heart and mind to connect and to see just a little more clearly. And may this understanding, this clarity, this kindness, carry itself forward into the world as we gently manifest it. May the seeds that we've been planting continue to grow. Seeds of kindness, of wisdom, compassion, patience, equanimity, all these seeds that are being cultivated in our own heart and mind. And ending tonight with a little piece from the Metta Sutra. Just the beginning. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none, through anger or ill will, wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, the only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upward to the skies and downwards to the depths. Outward and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will. Thank you. this is our last evening here. Really taking the advantage to feel how you're feeling, what is the level of energy. Doing a little bit of walking if you wish, if you're extremely exhausted and tired. It's a very great thing to also rest in bed. If you have a lot of energy, it's a great thing to practice a little more, because this is a precious opportunity which will end very soon. I wish you all a wonderful night and see you in the morning.